This unexpected, unscheduled episode of the Python Perspective is brought to you by social distancing. Social distancing, when you're required to stay in your apartment away from human contact, it gets you to concoct strange and interesting schemes via Skype with old friends who are also under vague degrees of quarantine scattered across the globe. Welcome to The MASH Report, a one-off minisode sponsored by The Python Perspective. On the 50th anniversary of its theatrical release, we look back at Robert Altman's feature film, MASH, and ask, what was innovative material then, what continues to be successful now, and what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me is my co-host, Anna, environmental scientist and analyst. Welcome, Anna.
Hello.
So, I sprung this on you a couple of days ago, Anna, trying to sucker you into my weird project where we're interested in discussing whether or not comedy specifically holds up after half a century. And with, as of today, on Wednesday, March 18th, it is 50 years to the day of the widespread theatrical release of Robert Altman's MASH. Anna, you and I know each other because you used to work at a video rental place. However, I don't know what your relationship with film at large is, with your relationship with this film, or with Robert Altman as a director. Why don't you start there?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'd have to say, in all honesty, I think this is the only Robert Altman film I've ever seen. So that's
you didn't watch Robin Williams' Popeye?
I don't believe I have, Ben.
Well, good for you. It's probably wise. We'll get some angry mail about that, but probably wise to have avoided it.
Yeah, I'd say although I was heavy into film when you knew me, I had to give it all up after watching Requiem for a Dream. I think that was just like it was too far. And then since then, I think it's more of a hobby. Although I will say I've gotten more into it recently since it's a way to seem very cool to my dates. to take people to an indie movie and seem like I know what I'm talking about. So I am having a little bit of a renaissance. I'm happy to show up for this in that way.
I would say the other film that came out about the time when we were hanging out together was a Altman film was Gosford Park. That had a bit of a Altman renaissance slightly a couple of years before his death. And that was a movie that highlighted at the time one of his major tropes as a filmmaker, which is he wanted naturalistic, seemingly unplanned, overlapping dialogue. Mm. But I don't know if you were interested in weird British costume drama murder mystery.
No, that's all you, Ben.
Yes, you've definitely stuck the pin in that one. All right, so in general then, this is kind of your premier exposure to Altman as a filmmaker, and I brought you in on this because I wanted a fresh pair of eyes. This is a film that I literally watch at least once a year. Mm. I find this to be evergreen. I'm able to revisit it and find the humor fresh and to find new things. And because of the overlapping dialogue, I'm able to hear new things and relax into it and watch the acting and watch the background or watch a particular character. I've watched it this time twice in order to prepare for the podcast and like learned names of characters I never knew before. I find this to be a very re-accessible film, but I'm very interested in what person would think about it for the very first time. So What are your initial reactions?
Well, I don't know if I can stand in for any old person watching it the first time, but personally, I loved it.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think that it's probably not fair because I do hold you in such high regard and and take your opinions very seriously. And you did sort of prime me that it may or may not hold up, in our modern context. And I also was lucky enough to talk to my parents right before I watched it. Hmm. And my stepmom said, oh, I loved that movie. And I talked with them a little bit about just the context of like the Vietnam War. You know, obviously it's supposed to be about Korea, but not really about Korea, actually about Vietnam. And so, you know, like just going into it, like, you know, knowing that it was like one of your very favorite movies, and then knowing that my stepmom liked it so very much, and that it really spoke to people in such like an important way in the era. I think that I went into it with like a curiosity, I think, mm-hmm. that really kept me from being turned off by some of the things that someone who didn't have that context might, you know, might throw their hands up and be like, you know what, this isn't for me. Like, this really has too many isms, I think, is a common criticism of the movie in the modern context, but that didn't slow me down any.
And if you were to recommend this movie to somebody else, what would be the thing that stood out to you that you would say, oh, this is why I think somebody else would like it?
I mean, it's hard because I did go back and sort of look at how people feel about this movie in the modern context. And I think that people really disagree. You know, there's a lot of different feelings and a lot of people can't get on board with it and are really stuck on some of the things that come up in the movie, which I'm sure that we'll get to. And so it would be hard for me to recommend in sort of a blanket way. I thought that it was just a really, I don't want to say heartbreaking. I think that's kind of over the top. But to me, it was like an unparalleled depiction of war in a time where the people going through that, not necessarily people who were in the war, but people who had friends or family member who were in Vietnam, were experiencing just like an incredible level of distress and an incredible level of anger towards the people who were making those decisions. And the movie really captured that kind of sentiment. And I think that as sort of like a historical document reflecting those feelings, you know, I loved it. I loved that. yeah, I don't want to go too overboard, but I think that...
Well, let me just say, going overboard is kind of historically precedented by this film. When it was reviewed in The New Yorker by legendary critic Pauline Kael, she ended her review by saying, "This sounds more like a testimonial than a review, but I don't know when last I had such a good time at a movie." She was ecstatic about it. She really got sucked into the film. She was in love with the way in which the targets, all the targets who should be laughed at, were mocked. And she found that it was revolutionary in terms of its departure from other war comedies, where she says that traditionally they tend to be about little guys who foul things up and then become heroes by accident. And that this was different in that the people who were the heroes of the movie were hyper competent from the beginning, and that the film was about their relationship with power, but that it wasn't about them. Like, Stripes is a movie that falls into the kind of thing that she was criticizing, where you have these bumbling idiots who eventually learn that really what they just need is some good army discipline to bring out the best in them. Whereas this movie is very much not about that. It's about a refutation of the idea that discipline is a thing that is needed or helpful, particularly when dealing with the trauma of war. So praising it over the top is not unusual. It ends up in several top 100 comedy lists or top films of all time lists. As recently as 2017, there was a top 100 comedies list, and I believe it was number 43. It's frequently touted as being one of the best comedies ever made. But you are right in that I wanted a fresh perspective on this, in part because in advance of its 50th anniversary, The Guardian ran a column by Noah Gittel on the 22nd of January, where he said that this film desperately needs to be reevaluated in a modern context because it has a huge problem with misogyny and has buried problems with racism and sexism and homophobia, and that all of these things aren't intrinsic to movies that were made at the time, that it was therefore a choice that was made in a combination between the screenwriter, the original novel upon which it was based, and the director, and that to continue to put it on lists with such high praise continues to reinforce the kind of terrible sexist attitudes that the heroes of the film perpetrate, and that we need to therefore reevaluate it so that it doesn't continue to provide that as an example for people who are looking for great comedies to then emulate in their own films later.
I have opinions. I have feelings.
I have opinions, but I want to start with yours.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. I think the idea that anyone is going to watch this movie and feel like these things are something to emulate, I don't think that's going to happen. I also don't think that the ideas in that article are novel. I think a lot of people have that reaction and those reactions to this movie, and that's fairly well trodden ground. But I think that part of the reason why I feel sort of free to like this movie is not only that that is well trodden ground, has been abundantly covered, but also I don't really find a lot of modern movies to be free from misogyny or racism or homophobia. I think that they are toned down at a level where they are microaggressions. Mm. And so in our modern context, they are much more palatable. But I think in 50 years, they are going to be offensive at a level that we may really regret. And so I think that, you know, when that author says like, oh, you know, like this wasn't a given for the time. I mean, that's literally what my stepmom said. She's like, oh, but you know, it was just a different time. And, you know, I don't know. I wasn't there. And I think that partially he's right. And I think that while watching the movie, the way that I felt about the Major Houlihan, who is like this pivotal character where like this misogyny is played out, she brings to mind Nurse Ratched, which is like another one of these like very major characters from that era where a lot of misogyny is, you know, we feel it, we play it out on screen. But I think that this is a moment where the screenwriters, or as a culture, we are wrestling with women representing the establishment because of the cultural shifts that are going on, which is, it's uncomfortable. It was uncomfortable to watch. But at a couple of moments, I was like, I mean, very visibly, Houlihan is supposed to do that in the movie. But I think also the background to what was going on in America, where there are more rules being put in place about like what you can and can't say, what you can and can't do, like who women are in society. Because of those rules, it feels like, oh, women ruin our fun. Hmm. And they are part of the establishment, and they are this thing to rebel against symbolically.
That's interesting. I love the fact that you compare it to Nurse Ratched, because When Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest came out 5 years later in 1975, and the depiction of Nurse Ratched in the book, in the original Ken Casey, one of her primary characteristics is that she wears a very tight, starched uniform that cannot prevent her breasts from being visible. Mm-hmm. And that one of the weird tensions that Kesey establishes is that her body wants to be maternal, but her role is not. Her role is the opposite of that. And she's very deliberately structured as this warring series of conflicting images to the men in the ward. And I think the casting of Louise Fletcher physically removes that. She becomes sort of a legendary film battle axe, where she's just about being a hard-nosed, very strict, very aggressively sort of square person. Mm. When we're introduced to Sally Kellerman's Major Houlihan, she is very deliberately set up as somebody who is attractive.
Captain Pierce, may I join you?
You've already joined me, gorgeous. You're a sight to sorrow.
And who could be somebody who fits in with the group. She's a major, so she outranks our captains. Our surgeons are all captains, and she's one step above them. And so there's this minor power play there in terms of she outranks them, she should be telling them what to do, but they have the authority as surgeons over her as a nurse, and authority as experts in the field over her as somebody who's less involved with the necessity of keeping soldiers alive.
Captain, I've been observing the nurses on your shift.
Yeah, I know, I saw you.
Naturally, your own opinion is more informed than mine.
And you would like to know what I think of the nurses on my team. About that?
I think, therefore, there's potential importance in being able to look at the way in which they treat the other major, Major Frank Burns, her co-conspirator, the other person that they consider to be beneath their respect and who they get tossed out of the camp.
Frank Burns,
does not know his way around an operating theater. He does not know his way around a body. And if you will have observed anything, you will have observed that Major Frank Burns is an idiot.
And the way they treat her, and see if there's any difference there in the quality of their relationships that might indicate that there is a misogynist aspect to the film. If they're treating Major Burns and her in different ways, then there might be misogyny in the sort of DNA of the film. Does that make sense?
I don't think it stands to reason. I think that they...
Okay.
I think that the film can still be expressing a misogyny towards her. We also see her much longer in the film
than
we see Major Burns. But I think that sort of like sitting, putting them side by side and being like, well, they're, you know, they're really pretty bad to both of these characters, and so the film is not misogynistic. I don't know if that's where you're headed with this argument, but I would say I'm not quite on board with that logic.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I wasn't actually going to reach that conclusion. I was going to put it out there as a possible way of evaluating it, but I like the fact that you're just going to shoot it down. And I think your point is that Burns is gone very quickly. I'd say it takes 20 minutes for Elliot Gould's character to get introduced, and it's about another 20, 25 minutes before Burns is removed. And yes, Sally Kellerman's character stays throughout the entire rest of the movie, and her conduct and the way in which they treat her evolves over that film as well.
Let me have a forceps and a sponge stick. Hot Lips, you may be a pain in the ass, but you're a damn good nurse.
But you're right, that therefore more things can happen to her, which would make it imbalanced to be able to say the treatment of her is different because she continues to be a major figure in the film,
so
whereas
speak.
Burns is able to be removed, so to speak.
Major, so to speak. yeah, I think even if they had had the same amount of screen time and position in the plot, even that would not make me feel like we could compare them one to one and say, oh, well, the film is not misogynistic because of that.
One of the criticisms in Gittell's article that I thought held up very well is that when each of the characters is given their moment at the very end of the film, the film breaks through the fourth wall at the very end after giving us a number of announcements over the PA systems in the camp about various entertainments and lectures and things and announcements going on, including a number of war movies that they played for the doctors to sort of keep their spirits up by rousing wartime action. It then ends with an announcement that you have been watching a war film, and here are all the people that are in it.
Attention. Tonight's movie has been MASH. Follow the zany antics of our combat surgeons as they cut and stitch their way along the front line.
It goes through a quick montage of all the different actors. And the shot that we get for Sally Kellerman is the shot of the tent flap of the shower being raised up and her covering herself. And Gittell's point is that doesn't treat her like a human. That treats her like a sexual object. Everybody else gets a close-up. Everybody else gets a moment of saying, here's their hero shot. Here's them looking respectable and charming. And here's one more flash of Sally Kellerman's body. I do find it hard to argue that that is a respectful way of treating her. They could have showed her face. They could have showed one of the many shots of her eyes while she was operating as a nurse and really has really great expressive, soulful eyes, particularly when you can see her not saying how sad she is that Captain Duke Forrest is going to leave and after they've developed a relationship. They could have done a great many things, but instead they were like, ha-ha, we're going to show you this bit again. Yeah, we got away with it.
Yeah.
That sucks.
Yes, I do agree with you. I think that for me, it doesn't surprise me at all. And it feels like on par with this this other thing that I've been saying, which is it seems like, you know, like a modern movie, which focuses on a woman's body as sort of the most interesting thing about her. It feels very common and not super surprising. But also, I don't think that she's a character.
Hmm.
She is an object in the plot in, or not that there's so much of a plot anyway, but in the movie, she is representative of the struggle that the main characters have. These two guys, like, they don't want to be there, right? They want to be somewhere else, maybe home, maybe not. And she represents the army, right? They call her
a regular army clown.
Correct. She's regular army.
Right. And she's all about the rules. Like, she's really uptight. She's not one of them. And she shows up, and, you know, in that the first scene that she has a conversation with Hawkeye, and then, like, they both get up and kind of go their ways. And, you know, somebody, you know, says,
I wonder how a degenerated person like that could have reached a position of responsibility in the Army Medical Corps.
He was drafted.
She is representative of the central conflict, but she's not a character. Like, she doesn't have her own motivations. You know, by the end, she has transformed, but it's not in a way that's meaningful to her as a character. It is only as a response to their bullying and to kind of, like, collapse under their, you know, like, this central pressure of the film. So I'm not excusing the fact that they are showing her body as a representation of who she is as a character, but I think that it is more representative that she's not really a character at all, but more of this sort of, like, a vehicle for the plot and this pressure that they're feeling.
Now, the film is, to a degree, eclipsed by the success of the television show, which famously starred Alan Alda and went for 11 series, I believe, and which still maintains the record of having the most watched finale of all time. Like, millions of people tuned in for its last episode. It's an extraordinary cultural icon, and most people, when you say MASH, think about the television series. They don't think about this film. In fact, very, very few people have seen the film, despite it being such a major cultural event at the time. Despite winning Best Picture at Cannes, the third American film to ever do so since 1948, astonishingly important film at the time, and then utterly forgotten in the face of the television show. If what you're saying is that she doesn't really have a character, but that she transforms, that she is able to, under their influence, somewhat malign, somewhat selfish, but still in the ethos of the film, the important transformation to create what is a better set of values. Do you feel like if the television show had continued directly from that she would have had time and space to develop as a character once the people that transformed her had left? Would she have her own agency? Or would you feel like she would just revert back? Like, what would be your prediction as to how the television show... And I don't have an answer to this question. I've literally only seen 5-10 minutes of one episode of the show. My suspicion is that she goes back to being the bad guy in the show, because that's easy. But
I mean, I think that she's only the bad guy because it's Vietnam, and the good guys are these guys that don't want to take authority from a woman, you know. There are these complicated elements to tease out. Like, is she actually, I would say that part of the reason why this movie is complicated is because the protagonists, the main characters, are not good guys.
No, and I
think that for for a lot of people sitting down to watch that or watch this movie, that is going to be a real sticking point. And so positioning her as the antagonist, where she is the bad guy, is really fraught, especially when they start to sexually harass her, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, hi, Hot Lips.
Oh, my goodness, over my... I'm so sorry to touch your butt. Well, what's the matter with her today?
Oh, I don't know. I think it's one of those ladies things.
And so for me watching this, I'm at a place in my life where I'm like, that's fine. There's no heroes. You know, she's she represents the establishment. And I accept that in this movie, we're here to criticize the establishment. So I got on board, right? And I can enjoy the movie and find it funny and valuable. But I think for a lot of people, there's going to be a cognitive dissonance where that might never gel for them. And as far as, like, where she goes at the end of the movie, I mean, where she was at the end of the movie, in, like, a literal sense, is, like, really traumatized.
Yeah. Well, I think, for example, to compare her to the Colonel, that he is a man who represents the establishment but has found his own balance. He, like the main doctors, like the captains, has his wartime mistress, but has a wife at home. There's a subtle minor scene where he's getting in a Jeep to go off and meet with a general, and she says, "Oh, nice jacket.
Great jacket, isn't it, new?"
"Oh, yeah, it was sent to me."
He avoids saying, "My wife sent it to me." I don't know that his wife sent it, because it's literally not said, but it's the only interpretation I can come to that line of dialogue. He's therefore trying to spare her feelings by bringing up the fact that this is never going to last. But everybody is aware that what they're surrounded by is temporary, is never going to last. And so he's able to fly fish in the pond outside the edges of the camp. He's just able to try and find little things to create a fake normalcy. And so the question is, does this regular army clown, this woman who is so enamored of army protocol that when she steps off a helicopter, the first thing she does is stand to attention and salute, despite the fact that that means that she might get her hand and her head chopped off by the copter she just stepped out of, and has to be reminded, "Oh, duck, woman, duck," because you're endangering your life by paying attention to regulation. Does she learn that she also needs to find some sort of anarchic balance between the way to survive and the way to help people? Or is she just doing that for the moment? That, I suppose, is the question of, does she have a character? If she doesn't have a character, then she won't learn. If she is a secret person behind the scenes, even if we're not shown that because the movie isn't about her, and she learns these lessons off screen, her romance with Duke happens mostly off screen, that therefore maybe she could be like the Colonel and have her own weird balance of being helpful to the new doctors who come in and the new nurses who come in after the movie is over.
Mm-hmm. Well, we never get to see it if it happens. I can believe it, but I feel like the parts of her that we do see towards the end are this very one-dimensional, again, sort of a vehicle for, you know, like the football game, right? Mm-hmm. When she's a vehicle for the joke that women are stupid and don't understand sports.
Yes. There was a columnist in the New York Times soon after this movie came out, Richard Corliss, who previously wrote for the National Review. One of his major criticisms, and he wrote an article that basically said, "I think I need to stand for the minority of opinion that this is not a good movie," when it first came out, was he was offended by the fact that she basically turned into a cheerleading idiot from having been a nurse in charge of other nurses, incredibly important, and then is just doesn't understand the rules, is cheering and flailing about and basically abused by Henry, where he calls her various kinds of dumb 5 times in a row.
"Look, a red flag! We've got a red flag!
It's a penalty, you blithering idiot."
Yeah. I mean, that kind of behavior from like a real person, if you saw a real person behaving that way, you would be very concerned about what happened to them. That would be a very dramatic shift.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we do see, you know, when she does have like this sort of intimate moment with Duke at the end where he's like, I don't know, no spoilers, right? But see...
It's all spoiled. It's a 50-year-old film. It's literally a 50-year-old film.
I think that they were able to integrate some subtlety back into her character in some of those last scenes where, like, she is part of this group and here's what that looks like. But I think it was kind of too little too late, especially in the context of everything else. I mean, I think that we're not really in disagreement that there's a lot of misogyny happening in this movie. I think the question probably that we want to, I don't know what you're trying to bring to the listeners, but for me, it's just whether or not it's worth getting over to appreciate the rest of the film. And for me, it absolutely was worth sitting with to hang for the rest of it.
I think what I think is the major error in the article is what you brought up earlier, which is that these are not good or kind people, that the doctors are doing this out of a misplaced sense of their own arrogance. And I think what I want to make sure happens in this discussion is to point out that the term anti-hero gets thrown around a lot. And I'm not a fan of it as a way of excusing behavior. I don't think this movie excuses the behavior of the doctors. I think it explains it. And I think that's a key difference, is it says they are arrogant. They are sure of themselves. They are right. But that doesn't make what they are doing good. It is an act of survival, but it is not necessarily a moral act. And I think making them actual heroes, saying that this behavior is excusable, that this behavior is acceptable, that this behavior is emulatable, is the wrong conclusion. And I think that Cattell's point that this becomes a blueprint in the 80s for various other terrible movies like Animal House, where sexual assault happens, where women are treated only as sexual objects and don't have their own character. I think that happens because people got the wrong kind of message from this movie. They said, oh man, wouldn't it be awesome to be like Hawkeye and Duke and Trapper John? Those guys were so cool. Let's be like that. They're not cool. They're broken. And it is important to recognize that the things that they do are the kind of wartime desperate things that would never pass in polite civilization. It would never pass when they went home. And that she is a victim of their acts. And it may be funny, but it is cruel. And that nobody should think that what they did is good, even though ultimately the fact that, this only just occurs to me, so much of the military is built around the idea in basic training that they need to break you down in order to build you back up.
Absolutely.
And I've always hated that. But that's actually the moral and the message of this movie as well, is that in terrible wartime crises, you need to destroy discipline in order to build up an understanding and acceptance of chaos, because that's the only way to survive. Basically, no pun intended, they're putting her through chaos basic. They're putting her through the ability to survive in a world where there are no rules. And that rules aren't, creating rules in nothingness isn't a substitute. You have to, in fact, be able to go with the weird whims, the way in which they're constantly improvising.
Black capsule.
Black capsule.
Right. Oh,
black
capsule.
Yeah, that's neat.
What's a black capsule? Do you have any of them? Does it work?
It worked for Hitler and Eva Braun.
It was simple and effective.
The way in which they're always making up scenarios and just sort of riffing.
Darling, would you register for us?
Just no. A moment. You can't go in there.
No, look at
that. Who
I'm
are you?
Who am I? I am the Pro from Dover,
well,
and this is my
you.
Favorite
you
caddy.
And lying to each other and coming up with a new thing.
And Dr. Jekyll, actually. This is my friend, Mr. Hyde.
Is built on the idea that every moment is a moment to say yes to, because otherwise you'll die.
Hmm. Well, I love that perspective. I love that you brought that in, because I think that that is a great way of looking at this movie and the relationships between the characters. I don't think that I agree with you that they're not cool. I think that these guys are some of the original cool of that era. Are you kidding me? I think that Elliot Gould, like, psh, what a babe. Like, yeah. And Donald Sutherland, oh my gosh. Like, these guys are nothing if not cool.
Oh, don't confuse hot with cool.
Well, but I think that they're also showing some of the really core elements of, like, that 60s and 70s kind of cool, you know, where they're drinking, they're playing golf.
Idiot! He knocked me down the hill. He broke my umbrella.
Wish they wouldn't land these things here when we're playing golf.
Like, they have no emotions. You know, they don't have the tender emotions. They're like, yeah, babe, like, it's been cool. Like, catch you around, but first, like, and also they're brilliant, right?
That piece isn't even close to his
number. I know, it's nothing. But look, how many times do you get to go to Japan with your golf clubs?
They're, you know,
yes.
they hit a lot of notes where it's easy to love them. They're like these rapscallions, but also they're elbow deep in people's chest cavities, saving lives. And so I don't know if I buy it that they're not cool. I think that they are cool. And I think that they are bullies. I think that that's been, like, kind of well-trodden ground with people's perspective on this movie. But I'm not sure that I agree that they are unique to the genre or to the era in their depiction. And I think that the way that they treated women, or the way that this movie treated women, was not great. But I also think that some of the ways that women were depicted in this movie were what was awesome, was totally fine. You know, that we see Major Houlihan having like really enthusiastic sex with Major Burns. You know, she's she's not buttoned up. She's about it, you know, and mm-hmm. on her own terms, you know, whether we agree with that or disagree with that, or whether we think she had weird motivations for it.
His will be done.
Or whether it was a vehicle for like this other prank. Regardless, I thought that it was a really cool aspect of her character. It's not one note. I think also seeing a lot of characters where like it's the really withdrawn, reluctant ingenue who's being sort of, you know, manipulated or pressured into sex. And that's a trope that we see like all through the 80s, 90s mm-hmm. and beyond. Mm-hmm. And it was not that way. We also see that with the other nurse.
Nurse Dish. Lieutenant Dish?
I think so, yeah. When we're first introduced to her character, and one of the characters is like...
Captain, I think if you'll notice the lieutenant's beautiful hand, she is definitely married.
Right.
And then, like, the very next scene, she's, like, pulling her shirt off. She's, like, on top of Hawkeye. And I was like, right, like, that's what, like, enthusiastic consent looks like. Like, she's about it. Like, she wants it, you know? This is not, like, some, like, she's trying to, like, push Hawkeye off of her. And, like, it's, like, some gross guy trying to, like, get something from her. It's not that way. It's, like, these people are in war and they are making decisions for themselves. And this is a woman who's making a decision for herself. And I thought that was like a totally fine depiction of a woman's sexuality.
I mean, I particularly like the way she leaves. I think that there's a fun aspect to the fact that she has just had sex with the comatose dentist who's got the the largest male member so big that literally people are looking through a crack in the shower tent like, in order to marvel at
turns,
it.
Taking turns to look at it.
And that she therefore has such great sex, she can be relaxed enough to go home and, you know, not worry about the long flight. She has one of the two camera breaks. She looks directly at the camera and smiles. And I always find that to be really charming, that the film acknowledges female sexuality in that way, to basically say, yeah, that would be great for her. I think the fact that it also restores Painless to no longer worry about his sexuality and go back to normal is a bad, you know, it's sort of an offhand punchline. I'm more enamored of the fact that the film's like, yeah, women can and should get it. That's always been my takeaway from that scene. And I think that that sort of gets lost in the politics of the fact that he's scared that he might be gay because he's not able to get it up with this other nurse in this other time. That, I feel, is the... It's the motivation for this larger other moment, which I've always enjoyed that. There's a scene in the book Ragtime by E.L. Doctorow where a man sees a couple having sex in a doorway and he's so offended by the fact that the woman seems to be enjoying herself. And when I was taught this book in college, my professor was like, see, this is Doctorow's statement about men in the 50s, is they literally don't believe that women should enjoy sex. And so that aspect that in 1951 in Korea, when this war was going on, that Altman wanted to make sure that Nurse Dish had a good time. To me, that's always been sort of the counterpoint to the character in Doctorow's book. Obviously, they have nothing to relate to each other, but it's a similar comment from people of a similar generation in pop culture.
It meant a lot to me. Especially going into the movie knowing that we were going to have this conversation about misogyny and looking for depictions of female characters, you know, one way or another, you know, and it didn't pass the Bechdel test. However, not every movie can.
No.
And in lieu of that, I think, you know, seeing these different depictions of sexuality that are really dynamic, I think, was important. Not only that, I think that the fact that Houlihan had sex with Major Burns it's not an accident, right? That the army major is having sex with this like deeply religious person. I think also how they treat religion in this movie is really fascinating. Just like how, like just like a no holds barred brutality that I don't see now in movies. It really caught me off guard, and I thought it was interesting that they were prepared to go there, frankly.
The New York Times, not the Richard Corliss counter editorial, but the official review by Richard Greenspan, he said, he opened his review by saying, To my knowledge, this is the first major United States picture to openly ridicule faith in God. And not fake faith. There are many pictures that pointed out that there were people who claimed to believe in God who were hypocrites. But that this was the first picture that basically said, people who really believed in God, you're hilarious and pathetic.
I mean, I think that's so interesting. This is the kind of thing about this movie that I couldn't get enough of, because it's really, it's not only is it not common today, but also like it felt very original, you know, for... I mean, not that I'm a huge film buff, obviously we have touched on that, but but that it really did feel just so interesting to look back on this moment culturally and think about what people felt when they would go to the theater and watch it, and what their lives were like as like a 20-year-old or a 30-year-old, and be like, right, that is the way that I feel, and they made a movie about it, and that's awesome. I couldn't stop thinking about that and how interesting that, was. So that's my hot take. That's why I think people should see this movie.
Fantastic.
You can, you know, understand your stepmom better.
Well, on that note, let's move on to our next feature, which is the MASH Report Minute. I have used the webpage random.org to pick a random number, and it has produced a scene, which I have for you to watch. You have 30 seconds to then summarize what happens in that scene. If you are able to summarize all of it, you win the first challenge. And then the second challenge after that is I have 5 quiz questions for you to answer. And if you get most of them right, then you are officially a victor of the MASH Report Minute. Are you ready?
Oh, I'm ready.
Minute 49.
Time has come for us to say sayonara.
Oof.
All right, Anna, you have 30 seconds to summarize everything that happens in that 60 seconds. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Your time starts now.
Okay. Major Burns just suffered a breakdown because of the tormenting that that he was put through by the main characters, and he's leaving. He's I don't know, maybe he's going home, maybe he's just going somewhere else. He's subjected to some side comments on his way out.
10 seconds left.
Ooh, and then Hawkeye and the Captain.
5 seconds left.
They look happy. Oh, and then they have to go save someone's life.
Stop. Okay.
I took too long. I thought 30 seconds was going to be longer.
Classic rookie mistake in getting into the themes instead of talking about the details. One of the key aspects of that scene is, yeah, there's basically only one line of dialogue during the extended sequence of Major Burns being put in a straitjacket into a Jeep and driven off. Where Duke says,
Colonel, fair. If I nail hot lips and punch Hawkeye, can I go home?
Otherwise, it's just a performance of a song where a woman in a heavily accented Japanese voice sings Sayonara.
Mm-hmm.
Was apparently actually a fairly popular song. It's called the Japanese Farewell Song. And it's one of many Japanese language songs that are played over the loudspeakers over the course of the film. I'm going to ask you 5 questions about various songs sung in Japanese over the course of the film.
Oh, man. All right.
Question number 1. Tokyo Shoeshine Boy was recorded in 1951 and sung by Taruko Akasaki, but re-recorded for this film specifically in 1970. Tell me which one it's based off of. A. Chattanooga Shoeshine Boy from 1955. B. Shoeshine Boy is performed by Benny Goodman in 1936. Or C. The infamous murder of an immigrant in Toronto.
A.
Correct.
Oh, yes.
Question number 2. In addition to MASH, Tokyo Shoeshine Boy has appeared in other films. Of the 3 films that I'm going to read you, which one did it not appear in? A. Akira in 1988. B. Memoirs of a Geisha in 2005. Or C. Isle of Dogs in 2018. Which movie did it not appear in?
C.
I'm sorry, it is in Isle of Dogs. It's not in Memoirs of a Geisha. One of the other films that's sung in Japanese is My Blue Heaven, which was popularized in 1927, written by Walter Donaldson and George Whiting. Famously known as the title of the Rick Moranis-Steve Martin comedy in 1990, it's also the title of a movie from 1950, starring Betty Grable. What other war film prominently features a famous pinup of Betty Grable? Is it A, Catch-22 from 1970, B, Stalag 17 from 1953, or C, 1 Minute to Zero in 1952?
B. C.
Correct!
Oh. I'm trying to hedge over here. I panicked.
Famously, yes, there's a character in Stalag 17 that has the pinup and fantasizes that Betty Grable actually appears to him in the film in a weird piece of animation. Another cover in the soundtrack is The Darktown Strutters Ball from 1917 by Sheldon Brooks. The lyric is, gonna dance off both of my shoes when they play those Jelly Roll Blues. The original Jelly Roll Blues was a jazz foxtrot performed by Ferd, quote, Jelly Roll, unquote, Morton. There's a connection between MASH and Jelly Roll Morton, and it's one of these three things. A, like Hot Lips, Jelly Roll is slang for a body part. B, before becoming a musician, Jelly Roll was going to be a Catholic priest, like Father Mulcahy. Or C, Jelly Roll Morton is from the same part of Georgia that Duke Forrest is from. Which one of those three things is true?
Is it A?
It is, yes. Jelly Roll is slang for female genitalia, apparently.
I didn't know that.
No, neither did I, and I don't want to delve any more deeply into that. Thank you very much.
I will let you know when I find out.
Question number 5. Happy Days Are Here Again is performed in the soundtrack in Japanese. It was very famously used as a campaign song, and it is consistently identified with that politician. Which of the following presidents used it at his party conference victory? A, Herbert Hoover, B, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, C, Harry S. Truman.
Truman.
I'm sorry, it was Roosevelt.
Oh man, I was gonna say that, and then I was like, no, he's too serious.
No, in the 1932 Democratic Party conference, right in the heart of the Great Depression, he used the song to indicate that he would lead the country to victory. Happy Days Are Here Again.
What?
Which means you got 3 out of 5 correct.
Ugh.
And you were able to bring it in under the wire with 30 seconds. Therefore, you are a complete and utter victor in the mashup minute. Congratulations, Anna.
Thank you. Thank you. I knew I could do it.
So say we all. As always, we like to end the podcast with 5 moments. A moment isn't a full scene. It's just a brief thing that makes us laugh or smile or think. 5 brief aspects of the film. Anna, why don't you start with one of your first 5 moments?
I think the Last Supper scene. Yeah, when Hawkeye is saving his friend from wanting to commit suicide.
He is not committing suicide. He is only intending to commit suicide. So you're not dealing with an act, you're dealing with an intention. And if it works, if what we're doing works, then he will not commit suicide. So therefore you are preventing a mortal sin, okay?
Was both funny and poignant.
Did you think that the creation of a tableau representing Da Vinci's painting of the Last Supper, too on the nose, just on the nose enough?
I think that not everyone would get it. I thought it was really funny. I bet they were just cracking themselves up over and over doing that scene. It was really fun.
For moment number 2, I'd like to nominate the strange little bit of business at the beginning where Hawkeye is waiting to get in the Jeep in order to drive to the MASH unit in the first place. The bit of confusion that comes about because he, for some reason, only has 1 set of captain bars on his jacket and he's using it to pin shut the bag. And so that's when Duke comes over. He doesn't recognize that they're both captains because he's not wearing his bars. And so that's why he tells him,
okay, let's go, boy. Get him out of the bag.
Which gets Hawkeye 2, because that's his whole bit, is he's always saying, yes, and. He's always improvising. He says,
yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Pretends to be the driver. The camera shot is actually brilliant. Like, there's a little mini spot glinting off the bars so that you notice it. It's it's our first introduction to the long-running thread of them just making stuff up and playing games. And it's more subtle. But I think it's interesting that Hawkeye doesn't get offended. He doesn't pull rank. He just says, yes, sir, and then steals a Jeep. Because that's how far he's willing to take the bit.
I love it.
Give me number three.
Number three. I'm going to take it back to the dentist, their suicidal dentist friend, which is...
Yes.
Yes, very, very pivotal in the movie. Mm. And they're like, well, you know, how do you know that he's suffering? And the guy who brought it to Hawkeye's attention is like...
He said, what does it matter? It's only a game.
Painless said, what does it matter? It's only a game. Poker, only a game?
Yeah.
And Hawkeye's like, what? Just a game? And the delivery is brilliant. And the joke is like, it's a silly joke, but like the whole bit is just, it's silly, but so charming.
That's what gets him to understand how serious this
is. Yes, yes, exactly. Poker's just a game. I'm like, oh, hell no.
I'm going over there right away to investigate.
Exactly. Yes.
Nobody would say that, especially not Painless Polish.
That's right.
I do want to shout out Rene Aubergenois, who plays Father Mulcahy. He died recently, I'd say within the last year or two. An amazing actor and one of the tent poles of the stable that Altman used for a number of years. He's really astonishingly creepy in McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Really wonderful in that. That shows his rage. But I love the dedication with which he plays Father Mulcahy in this. The way in which he's always just a little bit late. He never quite picks up on what's going on. And he's so believable in the way in which... So even in that scene, like, he's explaining it to Hawkeye and then doesn't notice that Hawkeye is already... like a man of action, like stood up and gone away. He's still explaining it and then realizes, he's gone. Like he's always just a little bit behind. And he's one of the figures of fun that the New York Times points out, that a man of faith is mocked. That's not the case in the original novel. There's a whole sequence in the book where Mulcahy is able to pray for patients and keep them alive. His prayer is an act of intercession that the surgeons rely on when things are going particularly bad. They ask him to come in and pray. And there's one particular time that it doesn't happen. And it's a real turning point in the novel. Whereas in this, there's a very specific scene where Duke says,
I'm sorry, Dago, but this man's still alive and that other man is dead. And that's a fact.
And that sentimentality and that wish fulfillment of the idea of higher intercession is just completely gone from this film. But there's a marvelous moment. And what I'm going to pick for my number four is at the very end when Hawkeye and Duke are about to leave. Famously, Mulcahy blesses the Jeep.
Bless this Jeep. Send your holy angels so that all who ride in it may be delivered and guarded from every danger.
There is a actual prayer that he and Altman found in the Book of Common Prayer that's given to military chaplains to make sure that vehicles will get people to their destination safely. And so the prayer that he reads for the Jeep at the end to make sure that they get home is an actual thing that exists. And they gave it to him in full. He doesn't get interrupted. He has his little moment of victory at the end where he is able to get through the whole prayer and say amen, and he isn't mocked, and they get home. It's a tiny little gesture, a tiny little blessing to that actor and that character that he's able to do something important when it comes right down to it in order to get our boys back. And I do like that moment. As much as I like the moment in your 60 seconds where he's just about to find the correct prayer to bless Burns, and then the Jeep pulls away right when he's found it.
That's classic.
Anna, do you have a final fifth moment that you want to end us off with?
Well, gosh, does that have to be an exact moment?
No. There are no rules here.
Yeah.
This is wartime. We are We are trapped in our respective steel caves of the coronavirus. Anything we could do to survive, anything we could do to keep sane is legit. And I don't care if it undermines the authority of a powerful nurse. Anything we do is okay. So, yes, you don't have to pick one of a five moments. Go nuts. Go nuts.
I know. It's hard to constrain to just five. There's so many more things that I would want to say. I think like one of the first things that struck me, even in the opening scenes, is the way that Altman sets up these like little dioramas almost, where like a character will be talking and the dialogue will continue, but will sort of like slide away from their scene. We'll see these other scenes, you know, of, like characters walking around, like bodies, people dying or surgery, or, you know, maybe a guy with a dog, you know, a character like walking through a camp or into a tent while there's still sounds from the other scene or dialogue going on. I assume this is probably like typical for Altman, but this was just such a beautiful way of looking into this world. And it's another one of the things that I found so very captivating and sort of lent itself to this sort of historical backwards view for me, that even if I'm, you know, having a problem with like the isms or whatever other thing, that it's such a, it's like looking into like a little dollhouse or something with these characters sort of running around doing their lives in this very third person way. That I think it helped me feel sort of like tenderly about these people in this sort of abstracted view. I thought it was like brilliant and beautiful, and I honestly can't wait to watch it again. Oh, I'm doing it again where I go overboard.
And I can tell you from having read the script before we recorded, those are entirely the creation of Altman. There's none of that cross-cutting stuff in Ringlarder Jr.'s script. It's all his invention in order to create the overpowering sense of there's always something going on, and that was part of his invention and what he needed in order to have a sense of velocity and have a sense of chaos. And it's interesting that for you it created a sense of intimacy. I really love that. This episode of The Python Perspective is a special one-off focusing on the 50th anniversary of Robert Altman's MASH. Python Perspective was conceived by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily, and our special correspondent today is Anna Withington. Our logo was designed by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song is by John Philip Sousa and sourced by Creative Common Clips from the archive.org community. You can find this podcast and previous podcasts on pythonperspective.com. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at PythonPod. Podcast is an intellectual exploration of comic phenomenon from 50 years past. There are things, dates, facts, names, ranks of any kind that you feel we've gotten incorrect, please contact us via the website. We'll post it to our errata page on Python Perspective as soon as possible. Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Ben. My co-host is Anna. Anna, is there any place on social media that you would like people to be able to find you?
Sure. You can follow me on Instagram at Anna Withington.
And we'll see you next time, where we discuss Isaac Asimov's Caves of Steel, a murder mystery about people who aren't allowed to be in contact with each other and yet somehow is mysteriously killed. It's not topical or relevant at all. I don't know what made me think of it.
That is all.